Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Patrick, happy school vacation week to you.
Yeah, happy school vacation week to you. I don't know if your house is anything like mine, but it doesn't often feel like a vacation around here.
No, not at all. Now I'm watching some kids and they look like me, but it's still, I guess there's some education going on here.
Well, that's good. We finally done it. It took us till season three, but we've created an entire episode where the interview is completely focused on Medicare for All, single payer healthcare. I'm excited to share this interview that I did. We'll talk about it a little bit before we break for the interview, but really glad that we finally put together an episode focused on single payer healthcare.
So you're sure it's not Medicare for All who wants it?
No, that is co-opting of the term.
Well, that's it was a cute try by Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah, we'll actually hear our guest address that type of co-opting of the term.
He did get transportation secretary out of it, which is better than small town mayor.
He did. Even though I've heard reports of transportation not being super smooth in the town where he was mayor, but let's save that for another day. Yeah, what happened with the old impeachment take two try, Dan? What did you think of that?
To me, it was like a necessary evil, but I think that it was kind of like a little bit of PTSD, right? Because I know for me, this is just a personal anecdote, but I typically don't watch cable news, but from about October to early January, late December, I had cable news on all the time. And then
I don't recommend that.
Yeah, no, it's not good for your blood pressure. But after January 20th, sometime before then, probably around the insurrection, I canceled it. And for a good 2-3 weeks, I would just log into my regular newspaper apps and check out some stuff. But it wasn't that big of a deal what was going on, right? The front page headlines were not disturbing. And so this came up, and it was anytime you get all of America hyped about something, that's important. You should pay attention. And honestly, my big takeaway is that I think what the piece a lot of people are missing is that, 7 senators, 2 of whom I would consider very conservative, Richard Burr and Cassidy, Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, went against Trump. And Cassidy even went so far, he has an amazing Twitter post, and he was I voted to impeach Trump because he's guilty. And then he just laid it out in 3 paragraphs. So I think that kind of gets missed because it doesn't matter really. Do I give a shit what Bill Cassidy says? I mean, I don't, but it is a signal that, because what does he get out of that? He gets absolutely nothing out of condemning Trump.
Yeah, I don't know if he's trying to set himself up to kind of be one of the people who takes the party in a new direction. I do agree with you that it was a necessary evil in that you can't just let that kind of behavior go unaddressed. And I do think the House managers did a really good job of laying out a case that,
right,
made it really clear. And actually, that shows in public opinion. The public opinion polls are showing that a pretty sizable majority of Americans are pretty upset that Trump was not found guilty by the Senate. And, like you said, the number of senators from the GOP who voted, that he was guilty is pretty telling. That's the most that has ever happened in the history of impeachment trials in the Senate.
Right.
But I think it is just poorly timed, and the optics kind of play right into Republicans' hands in that, you know, we still have not yet finalized this this big COVID bill. And I think, you know,
what are they waiting for?
There's a lot of good stuff in this COVID bill. They're trying to, I think, hammer out the details. I think the $15, the transition to a $15 minimum wage is a sticking point. And, you know, there's a number of things that have happened that feel like, you know, Democrats are just shooting themselves in the foot right off the bat. So the fact that, you know, the campaigning for those two Georgia seats, they just were saying on repeat that we elect these senators, Ossoff and Warnock, and those $2,000 checks are going to go right out the door. Well, you know, people are expecting a $2,000 check, not a $1,400 check. And you can't claim it's from the same tranche of money or it's from the same coffers when you're going to now set new eligibility standards. You know, if it were from the same exact payment, then you'd have the exact same eligibility standards. And so means testing, in my opinion, is often a waste of time because it costs money that you could be using to provide aid. But it just seems like Democrats, you know, I think they're doing a lot of good things that are going unnoticed. I think Biden is working pretty hard to undo a lot of the damage from Trump, but you just got to get some of these things done. Like, people are hurting, you know, people are right on the brink of homelessness or hunger, and it just needs to happen.
Yeah, I don't get it either. I mean, is some of it just this, like, this fake, like, bipartisanship thing where, like, you're going to get two Republican senators? Or is it that they don't want to use reconciliation? Because if you use it, my understanding is if they use it for this, like, he wants between a $2 and $4 trillion infrastructure bill. And that might be way beyond what most Republicans would sign on for. So don't they kind of want to save reconciliation for that?
No, I think they're planning to use reconciliation for this bill, and I think that's a good use of it. And I think what's silly is spending time trying to figure out ways to make it bipartisan, like you say, the fake bipartisanship, because it just doesn't seem like Republicans are going to compromise at any point here. And it seems like if they're approaching you with, what, like a $400 million, $600 million bill, they're just not serious about providing the kind of aid that Democrats are trying to do. They're also trying to, you know, Democrats in this bill are trying to make sure that cities and states don't go broke. And that's something that didn't happen in any of the previous bills.
Yeah. So, I mean, here's the thing. Not that we're going to be passing this bill for any political reason, but when Congress men and women and senators run in 2022, talking about Democrats here, they're not going to run on, like, hey, you know, me and Lisa up in Alaska or me and Susan up in Maine really get along. It's going to be like, what did I pass through Congress, right? Like, what did I do for you while I was here? So, like, this, like, getting stuck in, you know, the first or the second month of a new Congress over some bipartisanship is just dumb. Because they're going to have to run on this.
If they really want to alleviate pain and make it clear to the American people that they've got their backs, they need to make some type of recurring payments. So whether that is only $1,000 per month, I think ideally it would be $2,000 per month, but they need to set up some type of recurring payments so that we don't end up with this giant crash where the bottom falls out after the pandemic and the eviction moratoriums end. You know, I think there's too much need around the country, and it also would serve as, you know, a Keynesian, you know, economic boost that I think would really get things going.
I've heard some talk about a trigger for unemployment insurance. Like if unemployment goes above a certain percent, it would just kick back in, because that's also part of the bill. As you likely know, unemployment's going to run out the current benefits in March. And there's a debate about whether to end them in August or September. It's like, really? You're talking about the month that it's going to end? I mean, they're still going to be in need, right? So they need to build in those thresholds where, you know, it kicks back in. So they don't have to keep passing more and more bills. Because I don't see the unemployment crisis going away by the end of the summer.
No, I think rebuilding those jobs is going to take quite a while. And speaking of jobs and speaking of, you know, a potential win for workers, I think I've got my eyes on what's going on in Alabama. You know, of all places, an Amazon facility in Alabama is holding a vote to decide whether or not to join their local Teamsters union. But that just would be so huge for it, even at wherever it happens. It doesn't matter where, but I think it would set off a chain of events where you've got Amazon workers across the country, you know, begging in to unions.
Yeah, of all states, Alabama, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I was shocked when I found out that's where it was happening, but I just welcome the news. Because...
Yeah, if they win, we got to get somebody like that on the show. So one of the workers or whoever mobilized it, because I read about Amazon was hosting some like all staff meetings where they were, you know, saying like, this would be a really bad idea. I highly recommend you don't sign up, you know?
Yeah, Amazon's been paranoid about this. They've been spying on workers, you know, even in the bathrooms and some facilities to make sure they're not trying to agitate and form unions.
Yeah, I mean, I think this could be a big move, although I'm a little nervous for them in that, you know, how many warehouses does Amazon have? Like, could they just move the, you know, this particular business one state over, right? Because that's what corporations love to do. Right. Why are there so many banks in Delaware?
Right.
Or, you know, like there's a lot of states that are really lenient on from like a tax perspective. So people just go there instead of wherever they're located. But I'm really hopeful for them that they make this happen. It could be like a tipping point.
Yeah.
So, Pat, tell me about the guest you have on today.
Yeah, so I spoke to Stephanie Nakajima, who is the director of communications for a group called Healthcare Now. Healthcare Now is set up to try to support the push for Medicare for All in different states. They work with different labor organizations that have interests in pushing for a single payer healthcare, and they do a lot of kind of lobbying and, you know, just explaining to people what Medicare for All could do for us. She really knows her stuff, and I learned a lot just in the process of interviewing her. So I'm really excited to play this interview for our listeners.
Awesome. Stay tuned.
Our guest on this episode is Stephanie Nakajima, Director of Communications at an organization called Healthcare Now. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism. Could you introduce yourself and explain what your organization does?
Sure. So, my name is Stephanie Nakajima, and I work at an international grassroots organization called Healthcare Now that works to pass the congressional Medicare for All bills, as well as supports groups that do state single-payer work. So we've got, you know, affiliates in almost all 50 states, and we support their work and other groups at the state level, multi-issue groups that also work on Medicare for All, like DSA, that work on passing, you know, legislation either in their state or they're also working on the congressional bills at both levels.
So when I first contacted you for an interview, you mentioned a big healthcare strategy conference that took place last month. Could you explain what that conference was, who was there, and how often these types of strategy meetings happen?
Yeah, so we hold this conference annually along with the labor campaign for single payer. So, you know, our group, we organize the grassroots. So just individual patients who care about Medicare for All. And then the labor campaign, they organize unions and union members. And we do our conference together. And we usually move around the country. So we'll do it, you know, on the East Coast. One year, next year, we'll move to the Midwest and then the West Coast. Of course, this year, we didn't do that. It was our first first ever virtual, you know, meeting. And for that reason, probably also our biggest, we had over 1,200 people in attendance. A lot of people who had come, I think about half had come for the very first time. And so that was actually sort of an unexpected and sort of a silver lining of having a virtual conference instead of an in-person conference. It makes it a lot more accessible. And basically what we do at this gathering is it's like a weekend to take a step back from the nitty gritty organizing work and think sort of bigger picture, like what the year is going to hold in store for Medicare for All organizing, what our opportunities and threats are going to be. And it's just time to get together with other groups around the country to sort of brainstorm and be inspired.
So one thing kind of struck my ear there was your mention of labor groups involved in the push for universal healthcare. During the 2020 campaign, I remember in Nevada, there was some pushback from some labor groups who kind of asserted that their union provided healthcare was top notch and they didn't really want to risk it with a Medicare for All type program. Is that not an argument you hear from labor groups?
Yeah. So, This is a great question, because there is absolutely a rift between rank and file labor and then the leadership of labor. So that union in Nevada that sort of was almost actively campaigning against Medicare for All, or rather was campaigning against Medicare for All, and issued those pamphlets that sort of talked about like the importance of like the union provided healthcare. Actually, most of the rank and file of that union, it was the culinary union, they actually supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. And that was because they sort of rejected leadership's stance on Medicare for All and felt that, yeah, they may have health care through the culinary union, but actually, even though they did have that health care, it came with all sorts of co-pays and wasn't comprehensive. And there was like a limited network. And then also, even if they have their healthcare there, they may have family members or friends who are left out of that system. And so that argument actually wasn't really compelling for a lot of rank and file. And we see that, you know, across the country that teachers, for example, are very pro Medicare for All, but the national teachers unions can sometimes, they either hold back on making a Medicare for All stance, or they're actually against it. Some of the more militant unions, National Nurses United, United Electrical, they're very pro Medicare for All. But a lot of times we have just like that rift between the membership of the union and the leadership.
Right. So you're saying the membership tends to go for Medicare for All, whereas the leadership stands against it?
Exactly.
Okay. That makes sense. So what do you find to be the most effective argument in favor of Medicare for All or a universal single-payer healthcare system? Do you tend to use the fiscal argument, the argument that outcomes would be improved, or the argument about healthcare as a human right?
Great question. So the first thing to know about it is all those three arguments you just mentioned, we win all of them. we win the fiscal argument. You know, Medicare for All is a much more economical way to run a healthcare system. We win the improved income argument. Other countries are definitely getting more services for their patients, for their populations, and they're also the health of their patients and their lifespans are longer. And then in terms of healthcare as a human right, that's something that's sort of and hasn't been questioned. It's actually been co-opted by the other side. So, you know, the centrists who have sort of co-opted universal health care, that's kind of where we came up with single payer, because, you know, at first we were advocating for universal health care, but then, you know, centrists sort of decided, okay, we can fight for universal health care, but through a private for-profit healthcare system. And right. So that's, you know, sort of where we've had to, as they've chased our messaging, we've had to reformulate ours. And so Medicare for All, even now, you may have seen, has also started being co-opted. So Pete Buttigieg came out with a plan that was Medicare for All who want it.
Right.
And there was Medicare Advantage for all who want it, you know. But, you know, there was just some polling in 2019 that showed here are the three strongest arguments for Medicare for All. Number one, that people would no longer die because they couldn't afford medicine or care. Number two, that the U.S. would no longer be the only developed country without a universal health care system. And number three, that families would no longer struggle to provide long-term care for seniors and people with disabilities. And so what do all those arguments have in common? For me, it's that healthcare is basically a human right. We don't really need to get deep into the weeds of like how much of the GDP we spend on, you know, healthcare versus other single payer countries and all that stuff. I think that people just deeply resonate with the idea of healthcare as being something everyone should access. And I think that's the argument that we lead with.
If you could break down either, you know, kind of the efficiency of single payer, the improvement that we'd see in outcomes. I know that you broke some of those down before, but if you could really flesh it out for our listeners, I think it really is telling when you hear all of these arguments put together as one.
Sure. So single payer is a much more efficient system than a multi-payer system for multiple reasons. One of them is that multi-payer systems waste so much money on things that we really do not want our healthcare dollars going towards. So that's stuff like administration, patient billing. Like, so I used to live in Denmark, actually Copenhagen, Denmark for 3 years. And when I would go to the doctor, there was like a part-time staff there just to schedule appointments. When I go to the doctor locally here in Boston, there's like a separate parking lot just for the admin people who are doing all of the billing stuff, right? So there's this huge waste happening in the system where, you know, there's this huge army of gatekeepers who are looking for any way to deny somebody a procedure that their doctor has ordered. Because, you know, the more care that is given, the less profits are made by the insurance company, right? So they want to create the system where you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get the care that your doctor thinks you need. So single payer does away with all of that. It says, look, here's the national list of procedures that are covered, and they're usually much more comprehensive than, you know, whatever your health insurance company is currently covering. For example, in Denmark, I mean, you even can get IVF up to 4 times, which is most insurance companies do not pay for it here.
Right.
And so there's, you know, there's an administrative efficiency, you know, insurers. One of the things that I think that we really don't want insurers to pay for is lobbying. So like our healthcare, like when you pay your premium, a part of that goes into lobbying Congress, giving money to Congress so that legislators are dissuaded from instituting reforms that would protect patients. Then finally, I guess, and I sort of touched a little bit on this, but in terms of efficiency of a single payer system, you know, the government will set all of the rates. So there's not like these totally wild rates between hospitals, between providers, between areas of the country. And they are done in such a way that you can like actually control your costs and plan for your costs in the future. So, you know, these completely runaway costs we've seen, you know, I think in the city or in the state of Massachusetts, we're getting, I think, an 8% increase in our health insurance. My family, we got 8%. We're going to be paying 8% more this year than we were paying last year for health insurance. And that's just wild. That's really a lot of money. And it keeps happening every year. And other countries don't see these crazy increases because they can actually plan and budget their healthcare systems around fair rates for providers and hospitals.
Right. And you mentioned administrative costs. I just want to see if we can put a number on that. I've heard something like 27% of cost for private insurance is administrative costs, whereas for Medicare, it's like 3%. Are those accurate numbers?
Yeah, exactly. So I would say 1 to 3% for Medicare. And in fact, other countries get it down around 1 to 2%. And then when you're talking about insurers, right now the Affordable Care Act requires, that's called a medical loss ratio. So it requires insurers to pay at least 80% of the premiums they get back into care. But that doesn't actually account for other administrative waste in the system. So hospital administrative waste, for example. And of course, it doesn't account for any of our, as patients, waste when we have to call our insurance company and fight with them over something which is literally unheard of in a single payer country. There's no place to call, there's no insurance company, there's nothing like that. So yeah, I would say 20% is the amount that they I would say like insurers are often ending up like paying on that, but there is also, it could be even more in terms of the system-wide spending on admin, just because 20% does not account for what hospitals are paying as well.
Right. And it doesn't account for those fluctuations in things like drug prices that you mentioned either. No. So we're, you know, it's not breaking news that we're facing a global pandemic that's taken close to 500,000 lives in the U.S. alone. When this first started, one silver lining that I thought might come of it was that it would finally convince people that we do need Medicare for all or some type of universal single payer healthcare system. How might this pandemic have played out differently if we didn't have the patchwork healthcare system that we do?
Ooh, that's a really complicated question. There's a lot of factors here, but I would say that we were behind other peer countries right from the beginning, and that absolutely had to do with the fact that we don't have a Medicare for all system. It's been a while, but if you can remember, like right at the beginning, like Europe and Asia were ramping up testing capacity and containment measures. But Congress at that time, if you can remember, was immediately tied up with this very American problem. For 2 weeks, we were trying to figure out who was going to pay for testing and treatment of the virus. You know, this isn't something that had been included, of course, this hadn't been included in the ACA, that like this kind of testing and treatment was necessarily covered. And, you know, to what extent were we going to do it? Like, are you going to be able to get tested every, you know, month, or how is it going to work, and who's going to cover that? And then, of course, at what rate will tests be reimbursed, and how much will providers be paid for this? This is such an American problem, right? Because other countries, the single payer, you know, the government says, okay, we've got this problem, let's buy a bunch of tests, let's buy a bunch of whatever, and with the power of the single payer, and then we will distribute it according to need throughout the country. And here we have like all these different insurers, and it's like trying to get them to be compliant with like paying. And then on top of that, we have 35 million people who don't actually have health insurance. And we, in a global pandemic, it's actually, you know, all of a sudden other people's healthcare is your problem too. And so, and that was actually like a big impetus for making testing and treatment free, when really actually all healthcare should be free. And so I think that, you know, we were behind the curve at a very essential time, like right off the bat. So South Korea, you know, South Korea has single payer healthcare system, has the capacity to test up to 20,000 people a day almost immediately, 688 free testing sites, many of which are drive-through. That took us months and months to get established. And the state's action, swift action there, is the reason the country was able to flatten the curve, prevent an overrun of the hospitals. Spain, Denmark, they immediately went in and said, okay, we're nationalizing all of our private hospitals and providers for the duration of the epidemic, something that America just couldn't do. And so, you know, we were just hamstrung by patient billing and private insurers and everything like that. Well, you know, other countries were busy moving around resources and preparing for the medical emergency that we were all facing.
Thank you. That's a really comprehensive answer to that. And I think it does paint a picture of the efficiency of a national healthcare system. In terms of getting to a single payer system, what are the biggest barriers that stand in our way?
Ooh, good question. Well, besides, you know, the most well-funded opposition of any movement we've ever had, I think it's going to be really, it's the biggest challenge, I think, of our lives, to bring a fifth of the economy sort of under public control and to actually abolish private health insurance. I think that's going to revolutionize our country, and I don't think we should underestimate that task. The thing that is probably, I don't know if people are going to like to hear this, but, you know, besides the fact that there's this huge opposition, or maybe because of it, to me, the thing that we really need, I think, more than anything else, is more activist energy. We need people who are willing to get involved in local politics and are willing to take on complicit democratic establishments, you know, and other organizations that are complicit in upholding the for-profit health insurance system. And that could be your local union, that could be your local Democratic Party, that could be your local hospital, it could be anything and anywhere that you as a person, as, you know, a local member of your community can apprehend the complicity in the system. I think if we don't have that, then we're not going to get to a Medicare for all system, because we actually need a really mass movement of people who are willing to stand up to the for-profit health insurance industry in a way that can actually match the money, the dollars that are flowing in from the other direction.
Do you think that we should try to win single payer at the state level, state by state first? Could this be an effective way to show people the effectiveness and cost savings of a single payer system, or would it limit the gains that we could actually see? Does it have to pass at the national level before we can fully see the benefits of a single payer system?
Yeah, well, many single payer countries are actually very small. So, you know, Malta, for example, I think it's like less than a million people, and it has, you know, something like a single payer system. And there are many tiny countries in Europe that have one. And so I don't necessarily think that a single payer has to pass in this like really big national level for it to be effective. But I do think that it's very possible that, you know, this was how Canada got its single payer program, right? You know, there was universal hospital care in one province that was passed in like the 60s in Saskatchewan. And that sort of spread from, you know, hospital care to like actual all physician care. And then it spread from province to province until finally a national system was established. And of course, yeah, there's going to be waivers necessary to actually implement a single payer healthcare system within a state versus like the national level, right? Because Medicare is a federal program and you'd be either supplementing or using those funds towards the single payer. But overall, I don't think that those are real barriers to implementing single payer at the state level. And it could be a pathway to single payer at the national level. In fact, we have a couple states that are really close, California and New York. It wouldn't surprise me if they got single payer within the next couple of years.
And what happened in Vermont? I remember hearing explanations that after the voters, you know, voted for it, that they decided it wasn't feasible or something like that. But in reality, it was, you know, behind the scenes, the industry working against it. Do you know the details of how the single payer program kind of was sunk in Vermont?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In Vermont, we don't really know what happened, but we do know that what the governor said about why it sunk was not actually true, because he was referencing a study that said like, oh, it's just going to simply be like too much money. But actually, the study that he referenced showed that it would save the state money. And so what we think really happened is that the businesses and then the wealthier residents of the state didn't want to have to bear a larger burden of financing the healthcare system, which is really, you know, this is really what we're up against, right? Right now, the healthcare system is very regressively financed, with lower income and sicker people paying quite a lot more than their fair share. And so when you switch to a tax-based, you know, income-based percentage of income to finance your healthcare system, then all of a sudden, just like all other public goods, it's being much more fairly financed along the income scheme. And you're going to get pushback from wealthier people who don't necessarily want to actually make that sacrifice. And so I think that's really like one of the big obstacles that we're going to have. And the political pressure on the Vermont governor was just too strong. So he ended up saying, well, we just don't have the money, when really it was, I'm getting a lot of political pushback from this.
Would something like a public option work, where some people can opt into a Medicare for all type plan? Or do we, obviously it wouldn't be a Medicare for all, but, or do we have to completely abolish private insurance in order to have the universal single payer system that actually works and provides the full benefits that we talk about of such a program?
Yeah, so a public option is not going to work for a couple of reasons. So those system-wide benefits that I mentioned before, when we talked about like the benefit, the administrative savings of a single-payer healthcare system, those you do not get if you just like tack on yet another health insurance system in the patchwork, right? That doesn't do anything to reduce the administrative complexity and waste of the system. That's one big problem. The next big problem is that all of the public option bills that, and there's four of them, I believe, in Congress right now, propose not to create like a public option that would just be like coming out of Medicare, which is like a program that's sort of backed by the mandatory spending of the government, but it would be a separate like self-contained funding system. And so if it were that, then how is it different from you know, any of the plans on the ACA? And the answer is that it really is not. It will have to, for example, create a system of co-payments, limited networks, all of the things that we don't like about private insurance in order to compete with the for-profit insurance plans that are on the market right now. And not only that, but because the public option will be like a public system, it will end up taking a lot of sicker people who are being dumped by private insurers who are really good at doing that, even though they're not allowed to. And so there's going to be like a risk pool imbalance there as well. A public option is just sort of like a Band-Aid on a system that actually, if it fails, can make the case for public insurance look even worse, really, I think.
That seems like a pretty big risk. I always thought the public option failed because private insurers didn't want it to exist because people would flood that option. But your explanation makes a lot of sense. How does your organization combat myths? Like, for instance, I remember in the 80s and 90s, there was a pretty strong myth spread about the wait time, and it still exists to this day, about Canada's national healthcare system. That, you know, yeah, they have a national healthcare system, but if you want a simple procedure, you're just going to have to wait in line for that procedure to happen. How do you go about dispelling those myths?
Sure. Well, the way that I start is that during the like 5 years that I didn't have health insurance, I was on a wait list of 5 years to see a general practitioner. Some people literally wait their whole lives to get healthcare. And that's the fundamental problem with our healthcare system is how unequal it is. We're not looking at just what are the wait times for the wealthiest people, but what are the wait times for the whole country? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that wait times in the US compared to wait times in Europe are sort of middling. We don't even have the best wait times. And that includes, like, obviously, you know, wait times for ER care. That's nobody actually makes arguments that other countries don't do timely emergency care. But the wait times are around elective care, right? And those wait times, Germany actually does quite a bit better than us on wait times. And so there's this misconception that other countries with public health care have longer wait times. But fundamentally, wait times are a function of what are the resources in your system. So how many physicians do you have and how many units of time you have for physicians to see patients? And actually, a system that does the kind of rationing that we do, because we tie up doctors with like this huge administrative burden that no other country ties their doctors up with, we actually could do better on wait times if we had less of the administrative complexity of a multi-payer system and a single-payer system that just allowed doctors to focus on what they do, which is provide healthcare. We could actually reduce wait times just by doing that. So if you want rationing and you want wait times, stick with the current system. And if you don't, then you know, Medicare for All is definitely the way to go.
And what can individuals who are interested in helping get a single-payer system in the U.S. do? What types of individual efforts are most effective?
So this is something I say a lot, and you've probably heard it before, but all politics are local. So definitely, I would say get involved with your local community groups. Find out who is doing Medicare for All work in your area. That could be a single-payer group, such as MassCare, the Massachusetts Campaign for Single-Payer. It could be even more local than that, like an RRA Revolution or DSA chapter or People's Action chapter. It could be your church or your synagogue. It could be your union that's doing Medicare for All work. So find out like what is the landscape of organizing in your community and get involved with that, I would say, because there's even in the state of Massachusetts, if we get everybody who is on the House bill from last session on again, we have still only 6 of 9 of our congressional reps who are on. And then on top of that, at the state level, we have tons who are not on, like more than half of the delegation in the state house is not on. So there's plenty of work to be done, even in liberal states like Massachusetts, New York, California.
I understand you have a podcast. So tell our listeners how they could tune into that.
Absolutely. My executive director, Benjamin Day of Healthcare Now, we host Medicare for All, the podcast. We do it twice a month. We do it on video. So we do like a video cast, and then we do it also just as an audio stream. And if you just Google Medicare for All, the podcast, Healthcare Now, you can find it.
Great. And I want to kind of end on a bit of hope. I hope this your answer to this question does provide that hope. But what's your prediction? Do you think we're getting closer to achieving a single payer system? What's it going to take, and when do you think potentially it could happen?
Good question. We are definitely getting close, and I can tell that the establishment is getting more freaked out about it. The fact that, you know, Joe Biden had to run on a public option, which he is still going to fight and hasn't really indicated that he wants to actually go through with. But, you know, the public option was too radical way back in the ACA days. It was just taken off the table already. You know, it was not a part of the ACA at all. And now our most conservative Democrat, who ran in 2020, had to run on a public option. So I do think that we are definitely shifting the Overton window here. Medicare for All is not only more popular, but more and more by the day seeming politically feasible. And that's what I think is sort of scaring Democrats who don't want to have to deal with this issue of taking on insurance companies. And so I think in terms of a timeline, I think that, you know, right now we have just about half of Democrats in the House on the Medicare for All bill. And obviously, we need like basically every single one of them to get on the bill. You know, I think that the last are going to be the hardest, but I also think that we can make leaps as we did in 2016. Actually, we made a big leap. We almost doubled the number of co-sponsors. And so it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, we made another leap and pushed Medicare for All onto the table in the next couple of years for sure.
Well, that is the hopeful answer that I was looking for. Stephanie, thank you so much for taking the time. I know that you've got a lot on your plate fighting for Medicare for All, and I appreciate you taking that time to talk to me and, by extension, our listeners.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So Dan, what'd you think of the interview?
It was really cool to hear her perspective. I don't know a ton about other countries' healthcare systems, so it stood out to me that she felt very fluent to me in other countries' systems, like sort of like what works and what doesn't. And it also stood out to me as a union member, and I know you are as well, that rank and file folk don't typically align with their leadership, and that makes me wonder, like, if maybe union leadership has an ulterior motive.
Well, yeah, I think it's a big selling point for unions to gain membership through the fact that they provide better health care than the average job.
Right. Yeah, and Bernie said something about this. I think it was in a debate with just Joe Biden. It was in one of the Democratic debates, but somebody came at him with like, well, if you give everyone health care, then doesn't that kind of screw over, you know, your average union worker who has, say, $10,000, $15,000 a year in health care as a benefit, right? Like, because they have to negotiate to get really good health care. And he was like, no, because when that goes away, when everyone has great health care, they can't underpay people as much, right? They can't be like, oh, well, I've known a ton of people, I don't know about you, but I've known a ton of people who've stuck with a job, say in corporate America, strictly for the healthcare, right? And they would have been A, better off mentally, and B, would have made more money had they gone somewhere else. But like, you know, doing your own startup or going to like a small mom and pop is just not in the cards if you have like a big family, or you have a pre-existing condition. So Bernie like blew that out of the water. It's a great clip if you can check it out at some point. But he was like, yeah, that's just like a false.
Having a single payer system would definitely strengthen the negotiating power for workers across the board.
Right. What stood out to you?
So, I mean, one thing that you just mentioned there that kind of strikes me as a missed opportunity, I forgot to bring it up with her, but the entrepreneurial benefits of having a single payer system, I think people would be way more free to set off on their own and create a new company which would in turn create more jobs eventually.
I know so how I just, into free market economics you are, Pat. So that's well, a really good libertarian stand.
It's a way to sell it and make sure that other people see the potential benefits for them. But for me, in terms of things that I learned, I did not know that Canada got their single payer system through a state by state, or in their case, province by province approach. I just didn't know that. I don't know why, but I assumed that Canada had a system like Europe for, you know, as long as countries like the UK and France have had, which, you know, Europe gained their single payer systems in the rebuilding process after World War II, because that type of system made a lot more sense and could be, you know, centrally planned by the country as the country rebuilt. So it makes sense that Canada didn't have that because they didn't have the destruction after World War II. But I just didn't know. And that provides me with a lot of hope that we can have movements. Like she mentioned, we're close in California. We're close in New York State to getting a single payer system. And I know that, you know, people like Senator Jamie Eldridge, who we've had on the show, is always working to get us closer to that type of system here in Massachusetts. So that made me hopeful that it wouldn't weaken the movement to build from each state, you know, and try to build that out from, you know, one state to the neighboring state and see if we can expand it across the country eventually. Mm-hmm. I had kind of worried that it just wouldn't work, you know, because you do have issues. If you've got a system of single payer in Massachusetts, say, and then you take a vacation somewhere that doesn't have that same system, how does that work? So there are some things that need to be figured out, but I got, you know, a little bit of hope from her, you know, teaching me that Canada started in Saskatchewan with their single payer system and it built out from there. I also think it's just striking and maddening. And, you know, I should have known this. I should have thought about this, but that when we pay our premiums for healthcare, we're essentially paying the salary of the lobbyists who are working hard day and night to make sure that we don't end up with a single payer system. So just by having health insurance and paying for our health insurance, we're helping to employ people who are, you know, in the halls of Congress talking to our senators and Congress to try to convince them that single payer is not the way for the U.S. That
right. Well, you mentioned like the 25% overhead that HMO, you know, insurance company has versus like 3% for Medicare. Like Bernie, if you heard Bernie talk about it, he would say something like, you know, there's no forms, more forms, right? Like he would just, it would just, I mean, it wouldn't be that simple, right? But you wouldn't be calling for referrals and filling out needless forms. And she pointed out, I think, like, so there's obviously efficiency in the provision of healthcare and that aspect, but imagine like someone with a sick parent or a sick kid, even worse, right? Who is on the phone for hours arguing, right?
Yeah.
Instead of getting a job or instead of teaching their kid something or going, you know, just doing something for themselves. They're like fighting, and to me, that 25% administrative cost is sort of like it's all in the name of, quote, saving money. But what is saving money when it comes to healthcare? Saving money is profit, right?
And like it's denying you the care that you need,
right? But that's profit. So like if they can say no enough times, right, they get to keep it.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that, I mean, that's the crazy part is like we're profiting off of people's survival.
Right. And that's exactly the point that someone like Bernie Sanders makes when they say that there's no business in having your healthcare system be a for-profit system. It just has all the incentives in the wrong place.
That's right.
Yeah, and last thing I want to say before we close out is that I'd like to dedicate this episode to my great aunt, Sister Anne Moore, who died last week. She was in her 90s. She had lived a long, full life. She had dedicated her life to the Catholic Church and to her order of nuns and to education. She had been a school teacher and then a principal, and then she helped coach and train teachers, and she ran she was the superintendent of Boston, or of all Catholic schools in the Archdiocese of Boston for a time.
Wow, that's impressive.
She's just a wonderful, loving lady. So she will be missed. She will be remembered fondly.
Rest in power.
Well, everyone, thanks a lot for tuning in. We'll catch you on the next episode of Trickle Down Socialism.
You damn right you will.
Listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message. That's 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.